WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Terry Gross is on assignment at the Sundance Film Festival, taping interviews which we hope to present later next week. Trumpeter and flugelhornist Art Farmer is now an official national treasure. Farmer is one of three 1999 American Jazz Masters named this month by the National Endowment for the Arts, along with pianist Dave Brubeck and tenor saxophonist Joe Henderson. Farmer came of age just in time to play with the big bands before many of them were wiped out by post-war musical and economic changes. But he established his name in the late 50s, playing bop and ballads in small groups. Farmer left America in the late 1960s when Europe seemed more hospitable to jazz musicians than America did. Since 1968, his primary home has been in Vienna. Farmer's 1987 collection of Billy Strayhorn songs, Something to Live For, opens with this Strayhorn Ellington composition, Isfahan. Terry Gross spoke with Art Farmer in 1987. He told her about moving from Phoenix to Los Angeles, where he heard players like Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Hampton Hawes, and Eric Dolphy. Farmer moved to L.A. when he was just 16, after he promised his mother he'd still graduate from high school.
What happened, I got this offer to go on the road with Johnny Otis' band, but the band was leaving about a month before the school was over, so I went to the principal. And I explained to him that this was my big break. But I asked him, since my record was good and my grades were good, could I still graduate with the class? And he said, okay. I said, well, would you put that in writing, please? Because by the time I get back here, you might not be here anymore. And I don't want to disappoint my mother. So he wrote this letter. He wrote a very nice letter, and in the letter he said if all the boys were as good as students as your boys were, then the school would be a much nicer school and blah, blah, blah. And he put that in the safe and gave me a copy of it. And I went back there maybe 10 or 15 years later, and I got my high school diploma. This was a school called Thomas Jefferson High School, and Dexter Gordon went to that same school, and trumpet player by the name of Arthur Walker, that used to play with Earl Hines, and Melba Liston went there, and quite a few people went there from time to time. And this was the first school that I know of that had what is now called a stage band. And we used to go around and play in other high schools in the Los Angeles area. And it was a great place for learning about music.
Were you ever able to thank the principal for doing that for you?
No, because when I went back, he was no longer there. He had moved on. So just what I thought would happen. He wasn't there. And so if that hadn't been in the safe, I don't know if I'd ever gotten my high school diploma. It hasn't been any good to me since then. At least it rested my mother's mind.
That was really awfully savvy of you as a high school student to realize to get it in writing.
Yeah, well, I was traveling with Fast Company, you know. You know, like, you just have to think fast when you're traveling, when you're living on the edge that way. I know one time I took a job with a band, with Jimmy Mundy's band. Jimmy Mundy used to write for Earl Hines, and I think he was the composer of a song called I'm Traveling Light. Anyway, we got stranded someplace, and the guys in the, we were about 2 weeks behind in pay. So we were with some show, and the show ran out of money. So the guys decided that they were not going to play unless they got paid. So he says, well, if you don't play, then you get fired. So everybody got fired. And you know, you have to get home the best way you can. So I went to him, and I told him right off. I said, well, look, that goes for these other guys, but you can't do that to me. He says, why? And I said, because I'm a minor. I was only 16 years old, so he had to give me bus fare, you know. Well, those kind of things, you just have to, you do what you can think of, and that's it, you know, you get by.
That's great. Well, I want to play a record before we talk some more, and I thought, as we're talking about the past right now, we'd play one of your earlier sessions, and I think this is one of the first sessions that you led. I'm not sure about that. You can correct
me on
that.
Well, it's probably near that. At this time, I was doing quite a bit of stuff for Prestige, but I must not have been under contract to Prestige, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to have done this at the time, since this was for Contemporary.
And this has recently been reissued. That's from the album Portrait of Art Farmer. The recording was made in 1958. We're going to hear you playing The Very Thought of You, and it's a really beautiful recording. Well, why don't we hear it, and then we'll talk about it. And this is Art Farmer, recorded in 1958, The Very Thought of You. Say, I think your ballad playing is really just exquisite.
Thank you.
And I wonder how you started gravitating to ballads, because it's something really that a lot of bop players either don't do or don't do very well.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me like you have a chance to think when you're playing a ballad. That fast tempo is not pulling you along, so you can take time and really sort of sculpture the note just the way you want to get it. You know, you don't have to move on to the next thing until you're exactly ready to do it. And there must be some other reason than that, but I really can't think of what it is right now. I like to hear ballads played.
Me too.
I like to hear someone who can play one well. And at the time that I came up, well, the criterion of how good a player was how good he could play a ballad. You know, regardless of how much he was into with the fast stuff, you know, you take a guy like John Coltrane, for instance. Well, it's always, yes, but can he play a ballad? And yes, John Coltrane can play a ballad. And Charlie Parker, yes, but can he play a ballad? Yes, Charlie Parker could play a ballad. You know, that's how they were judged by the older guys. You know, that's what they were. That's where you take your hat off.
Gee, you know, I'm almost surprised to hear that, because I assume that that people would be really showing off how fast they could play a lick.
And no, the older guys say, look, you have to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell a story, paint a picture. And even Dizzy says that, you know, that's the whole thing.
Do you feel like you're telling a story when you play? Are you hearing the lyrics of a song or thinking of another
story?
Well,
I don't think of the lyrics verse by verse or line by line, but just the overall meaning of it. And it's very important. It's very important because, like, if I learn a song that's, a song that has lyrics in French or some other language, but then I feel like I really don't know the song until I know the meaning of these words. Yes, that's really important to me. And then it's just the overall thing. And I try to get that feeling, try to express that feeling that's been expressed in the words.
You mentioned before that when you and your brother moved to Los Angeles, you met a lot of musicians there like Charlie Parker, Eric Dolphy, Hampton Hawes. Were they very influential to you? Because suddenly you had peers who were playing jazz. You were pretty isolated in Phoenix, and it doesn't sound like there was much of a jazz scene or a jazz community.
No, we were all influenced actually by the same. We were influenced by the people who had already found their thing, you know, like Bird and Miles and Dizzy. Those were the people that were influenced. Bud Powell and Monk and people like that. They'd already found their way, and they were the ones that were influencing us. And we were, at that time, we weren't really thinking about trying to find our own thing. We were just trying to play, more or less trying to imitate them at that particular time.
Did that work for you? At one point did you start thinking about finding your own voice?
Well, it seems like a gradual thing happened where you just sort of segue into your own voice. You don't just one day, at least when I say you, I mean me. I didn't just one day wake up and say, well, that's it, I'm going to go for myself. You know, it wasn't like that. It was just like over a period of time, you would get an idea of, do this or do that, you know, and then it would wind up to be somewhere. You can always see where there were little deviations, because when I was first influenced as a jazz player, it was my main influences were Fats Navarro and Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie, and I would take from all of them, but I was eventually able to add a note here and there.
Did you like them personally?
Yeah, sure. I liked all three of them, and I still do.
Didn't Miles Davis used to rent your horn?
Yeah, he used to rent it.
Wait, was his in Hawk?
Yeah. At one time, he didn't have a horn, or he couldn't get to his horn, so he would rent mine, and he would rent. There used to be another guy. I can't remember his name right now. He used to use his horn. So a guy used to work for Prestige. But he would come by and want to take my horn, so I would go with him, you know, just for safety.
What would happen if you and Miles Davis both had a gig on the same night?
Oh, well, that happened, and he expected me to cancel my gig.
So you had to tell him no?
I told him no. I told him that I wasn't in the horn rent business, you know, but he's never at a loss for words. He really insisted. He said, look, man, I'm paying you for the horn. I said, yeah, but, you know, that's not my business. I want to play too. You know, so you would think that he would say, yeah, well, I understand, sure. He said, man, I didn't know you were like that.
Why did you move to New York?
Well, I first came to New York in 1946. I came with Johnny Otis' band from California, and I got fired because I wasn't able to hold the chair. I was a self-taught trumpet player with bad habits, and I would use too much pressure and got a bad big hole in my lip.
Literally a hole?
Yeah, and I couldn't play for a while. So I got fired from the job, and then I took a job in New York as a janitor in a theater in order to stay there and study. And that at that time, 52nd Street was in full bloom, and I used to go to the street and then stay there, you know, go there and sit in with Dizzy's band. And then when time came for me to go work, I'd pack the horn up and go and clean up the theater from 12 o'clock until 8 o'clock in the morning.
When you had these bad habits and it was really hurting your lips, so you had to take lessons and break those habits, were those habits hard to break?
Yeah, they're hard to break, right. Certainly, the best thing that a horn player can do is get a good foundation. But being starting to play in Phoenix, there was no one there. You know, I was brought up in, and this is one of the faults of segregation. I was studying in a segregated school. There were no teachers there. You know, and I didn't know of any teachers in the whole city. If you're not playing the right way, well, then you're going to pay for it.
How'd you deal with the frustration of knowing that you had to undo all the stuff that you'd taught yourself? Because it really is hard to create new habits and break old ones.
Well, I just knew it had to be done. If you have to do something, you have to do it. You know, I just thank God that I had some help, that there was somebody around who could tell me what to do.
Trumpeter and flugelhornist Art Farmer. He's just been named one of three American Jazz Masters by the National Endowment for the Arts. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We'll get back to Terry's interview with Art Farmer in just a moment. First, let's listen to this 1960 recording of the Art Farmer Benny Golson Jazz Tet, which includes Art Farmer's twin brother Addison on bass. This is Art Farmer's trumpet solo on the song Avalon.
My guest is flugelhornist Art Farmer. When you were starting out in New York, you knew Lester Young there, right?
Yes.
He had this, I mean, not that I've ever heard him speak, but I've certainly read about it, and he had this kind of hip language of his own that he would use. Would you ever feel almost square by comparison because he was such the consummate hipster?
No, well, you see, in the environment, what would be called the jazz environment, there were ways of us talking to each other that so no one would know what we were talking about, for one reason or the other, with whatever there might be something that people shouldn't know what we were talking about, or maybe some things if it was money. Well, then I remember working with one band where the money was so little, we didn't want people to know what it was, you know. So if you ask someone, well, how much are we making tonight? If it was $20, which it wasn't, then they wouldn't say 20. They would say line 20. So if someone hears that, they would say, well, line 20. Well, that could mean like maybe that means 200 or 40 or who knows, you know. Well, but that was just one example. But Lester Young, he really carried out everything he said was like that. He never left that hardly. He had, when he was just talking to us, he had his own way of talking, and we just had to figure out what he meant. If he said one lung, well, that would mean one course. You know, after you've been there for one night or two, you know his words, half a lung, George Washington. If he says yetis, well, then that means leave it alone.
I guess you couldn't very well say, what exactly does that mean, Lester?
Well, that wouldn't be too hip, you know. You just sort of let it sink in.
For over 20 years now, your instrument has really been flugelhorn, which is subtly different from a trumpet in ways I will ask you to explain.
Well, it has a bigger sound. My first love is still the trumpet, but the sound that I was trying to get on the trumpet, I can get it more consistently on the flugelhorn. And regardless of what note you play, it starts with the sound. And if I'm not satisfied with the sound that I hear in my own ears, then it sort of has a way of blocking my thinking. So I can't improvise that fluently unless I'm satisfied with the first sound. So I prefer to play the flugelhorn for improvisation. However, if I'm working with a big band in the trumpet section, then I take the trumpet out.
I noticed before that you were fidgeting with a mouthpiece.
Oh, yeah.
Do you keep one in your pocket all the time?
No, but this one I don't leave it any place because the mouthpiece is the part that's closest to you and is irreplaceable. you can always find a horn. I would hate to lose the horn, but I would hate twice as much to lose the mouthpiece.
It sounds really odd considering the mouthpiece is this little yeah. thing and the horn is like the really expensive
yeah, yeah,
bigger
that reminds
part of the instrument.
That's the story. Like Nat Adderley was in New York. He used to live in New York, and one night he got robbed, and the people took his horn, you know, and robbed on the street. They took his horn, took all of his money, and he told the guy, he said, "Look, man, look, may I please ask you if you would just give me my mouthpiece?" He said, "I've been playing that mouthpiece ever since I've been playing. If you would please just give me the mouthpiece." And this guy said, "What? You want the mouthpiece? Well, oh, you want that old thing? Oh, take it. That ain't nothing. You can have it."
Story.
He was so glad to get it. He said, "You can take the money and take the horn, but just give me the mouthpiece." Well, that's the way I feel, you know.
Art Farmer, it's really just been so great to meet you. Thank you very
Thank
much
you.
For coming today.
Thank you, Tara.
Trumpeter and flugelhornist Art Farmer has just been named one of three 1999 American Jazz Masters by the National Endowment for the Arts. Terry Gross spoke with him back in 1987. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.